from the code, in my mind.
No, I mean, it was just put like, in. It was just, the whole business was just passed, apparently, a year ago to handle such things as this. So they've been able to have a grounds in which to arrest everybody, but sort out later without too severe punishment. So the misdemeanor, it could be either a felony or a misdemeanor. It was designed for this purpose.
Yeah, well, it's a repressive law designed in the last repressive year.
Yeah, okay, could be. I mean,
take a military law like conduct on becoming an officer. That kind of law is no good because anytime a higher officer decides,
I just can't get out of this bag that really something did illegal happen in the Union Monday. There were a lot of mitigating circumstances which I have every intention
to
come out, but it was certainly illegal. Now, I don't know what would have been best to charge them under, but my understanding is that mob action is better than anything we used to have on the statutes before last year. That's all. I mean, I think to make mob action out to be something horrible isn't really the truth. It was better than anything we used to have. Criminal trespass, for example, is indeed a felony, and that's that they could have been charged under criminal trespass, which says only.
Well, why did it have to be? I mean, look at if 12 or 18 or whatever were arrested because of certain sleuthing.
Yeah.
They could have been arrested on some thing, indicted on the destruction of property.
Yeah, but the point
the sleuthing,
is,
obviously, the arrest
no,
had
nothing. You're missing the point. At 3 o'clock in the morning, they had just received threats from members of that crowd that they had to open the vending machine room in the Union or else. And upon answer to the question, could you guarantee the safety of the machines in the vending machine room if we were to open it, the answer was no, we could not guarantee the safety of those machines. So the chancellor acted at 3 o'clock to have the whole place empty. There was no attempt made at that time, I think, to sort out what had happened previously or what was about to happen or who indeed was making demands or hollering or anything else.
As far as he's 18.
Blanket charged on mob action. Then, of course, since then, presumably, the machinery's gone into work to figure out who did indeed do those illegal things that were done. That's the only way I interpret it. If you give them any credit for behaving at all right, see, this
well,
is
you know,
what's going on.
Well, I agree that there's probably, I don't know. It's pretty hard. I mean, to say, you know, you feel that, okay, there they were, and they were destroying some property.
They had destroyed.
Yeah, they had destroyed some property.
It was a threat that there would be another.
It's hard to see that they didn't have a right to be in the union.
Am I right that the
union closes at midnight? No one's supposed to be in there.
Am I right?
It happens to be a rule of the union. You know.
Am I right that the university signed the complaints on the military charges?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So. One comment to be made is that if these kids are not convicted at their hearings, at the subcommittee A hearing, the university is going to be in kind of an untenable position. If they
That's
not necessarily so.
Why so? Why not?
Because I think university discipline is rather different from the issue outside.
No, but I mean, if it's shown at the hearing of a particular kid, that he did not
break anything. Mob action is just being there is mob action, okay? But what the court does with it is another matter, too. You can say, okay, he was there, but he didn't even realize, for example, that there's a union rule that closes at midnight, and also he was afraid to leave because he thought there were cops outside with dogs and clubs, and this was 1 week after Chicago.
Right.
I think there are good grounds on which the mob action charge can be dropped in the civil court after the university also finds the kid innocent. I don't think there's going to be any trouble with the vast majority of those kids. Because I was there and I can testify that they were scared shitless at 2:30, that they were convinced that there were people out there with dogs and clubs.
Which there were.
Which there were. You know? And they certainly didn't think they were going to be able to walk through that crowd and get home. They had seen TV like the rest of us, and they had every reason to believe, maybe more reason than all the rest of us, to believe they were going to get pasted. I don't think there's any problem in getting those kids.
Procession of Y through a brick through the Daily Illini window. My name is Bob Nelson. This is David Eisenman. This is the guy who threw the brick. I want you to keep that in mind. My functions are simply sort of timekeeper and fielder of questions. Dave is going to speak for about 20 minutes to half an hour, and then he'll open it up for discussion. I have to leave at 4 o'clock, but you're certainly welcome to stay as long as you want.
Okay, I guess this thing does work. Does it work? It does work. All right. You want me closer to it? I'm closer to it. Is that better? Okay. The morning of Thursday, April 9th, I got my Daily Illini, as is my wont, close to noon, and I found that it contained
a couple of interesting editorials, and one of them mentioned me by name. It was entitled, Nice Guys, Etc. And it starts out saying, nice guys finish last, an old saying goes. It had to do generally with the proposal of Students for Equal Access to Learning, who you know are collecting or have established a program by which we students will contribute $2 each for the next few years, each semester to the to a fund for our neediest classmates. And the Students for Equal Access to Learning challenged the state of Illinois to match what they raise. And as this paper was written, the Board of Higher Education in Illinois had said on the first round that it did not think it would match that money. I will tell you how the Daily Line I saw that. As a result of the board's decision not to ask the legislature for a special appropriation to match student-raised funds, the CO plan, which could have provided financial aid for many, many students who otherwise might not be able to go to college, is apparently dead. Make no mistake, the board knew what it was doing. It knew that telling the university to find the matching funds from within its budget was not what the students had agreed to in their challenge. A letter to James Holderman, executive director of the board, from student leaders made that explicitly clear the day before. Clearly, the board was saying it just doesn't want to go to bat for the students' proposal to help needy students. Because of the possible makeup of the group of poor students who might be affected, there are racial overtones to this matter. But even more, there are clear issues of stupidity, lack of commitment, and entirely messed up priorities. Note those things. David Eisenman, assistant dean of student personnel and one of the real organizers behind the SEAL effort, has said that his good guy efforts at this university, which have gone far beyond SEAL, are an attempt to see if this university bureaucracy can be turned around to function for good. The board's decision must be a real disappointment to him, to all SEAL organizers, to everyone who hopes that somehow or other this university and the government and society that support it will straighten themselves out through nonviolent means. A lot of talk has been made about how William Kunstler causes riots. William Kunstler doesn't cause riots. Here's what causes riots. Racism, militarism, imperialism, and political and judicial corruption cause riots, and Kunstler has only helped point out those ugly warts on this nation's face. Warts cause violence. And so it is that if more students who want to change this society, who believe that a way to do it is to give a meaningful educational opportunity to needy persons, who believe and hope that these types of goals can be accomplished by working through and for the systems that are currently controlled by the rulers of this sick society, if these persons are shaken in their laudable beliefs, well, perhaps that is all understandable for us, if not for the right-wingers who can't understand why students don't want to sit around and talk any longer. There was a second editorial in the Daily Illini that day that was entitled, Tell Us Again, Union Jack. And it begins, It is almost conceivable that so soon after violent action against the university, caused in part by the university's refusal to be responsive to students, that Chancellor J.W. Pelteson would once again personally kill a plan that would give students control over a currently incompetently run building which students pay more than $1 million a year. Which students pay more, oh, for which, I missed the for, excuse me, I thought maybe they're, but their grammar is usually very good. Now, at the bottom of this editorial, it says, with this latest act of high-handed, devil-may-care dictatorship, we see that this university is in no way, shape, or form interested in meeting student needs and desires. The channels are a fraud. In no real sense do they exist. The chancellor's escapades cost him $20,000 worth of broken glass, a campus in chaos, and an angry legislature. This week's disgusting and cowardly action, we are afraid but convinced, will cost him much more. All right, that is what I read Thursday morning, March 9th, when I went to my office. Now let us deal a bit with the facts. The facts of the matter are that on Thursday, April 9th, I was extraordinarily busy. I had 8 or 9 of my projects all coming due on the same day, and I had long-distance and short-distance phone calls to field, papers to write, the whole bit. But I really felt that this was the second day in the row that the Daily Illini had, A, misrepresented the facts about the state of the SEAL proposal, and it was probably the umpteenth time that we'd had a rather... to me, disturbing analysis of violence presented to us once again, that violent acts can be caused by certain people's refusals to do certain things. So with this in mind, I took out of my day 2 hours and I drafted a reply. I drafted, what shall we say, a position paper that A, corrected a few facts, and B, dealt a little bit with the question of the relationship between the way bureaucracies turn down people's requests and why people may or may not be violent. Now, I wrote this thing and it was enormously long, as most of the things I do are, and I knew it was long, and I took it over to the Daily Illini. Now, let me tell you a little bit of what was in it. In the first place, note the CO proposal is dead. The CO proposal, as most of you will recall, involved the students voting on several options, and the one they chose was that we would go ahead for 1 year unilaterally collecting this $2 fee from ourselves, whether or not the state matched us. Okay. Now, there was good reason for that proposal, for that option being provided, and I think that students voting for it voted wisely. We knew that we would run into some difficulties in getting the state to match this money. It isn't a simple message that we had to deliver, as will emerge. And so we kind of expected it to go sour at least once. It was not dead. Twice on the front page of the Daily Illini, the day before the editorials I've just read you, the Daily Illini said the exact opposite. It said that no money would be collected until the state matched, which was factually incorrect. And as you see, the editorial seems to continue that error, although they do have a tiny retraction on page 5 of this same Thursday, April 9th paper. Now, before I proceed, I want to make something very clear, as Mr. Nixon would say. I am not discussing me and the Daily Illini. I'm not here to quarrel with the Daily Illini. The people I will be discussing today are among my friends at this campus, and I think I can say that in all honesty. And the configuration I will describe to you is one which I think is so common that it needs to be looked at in some detail. And so I've taken this fairly trivial act, perhaps, to look at this configuration in detail. I may appear to be picking a fight with the Daily Illini. I'm not doing that. I think I could have avoided doing it better if the Daily Illini had appeared today to be sure that what I say to you is factually correct and that is an accurate account of what happened with the Daily Illini. Since they are not here, I'm going to have to do my best. I have some notes I took. We'll rely upon my memory, which must be faulty. Let me proceed. I took the letter which I had written, which was, as I say, extraordinarily long, to the Daily Illini. It was 24 inches long in their type. That's a lot of inches. It's a very long letter. I knew that. I went to the girl at the Daily Illini in charge of letters. I should backtrack a moment and say that before I even wrote it, I called up John Hundley, the editor of the Daily Illini. I said, hey, you guys have slandered me in the paper this morning by calling me a nice guy, and I must have an opportunity to respond. So we chuckled over that a little bit. And then I said, what does it look like tonight? And he said, well, it's a tight paper. And I said, okay, but is there a chance? And he says, yes, there is. So I had written my letter. He was pre-warned. I came in. I did not go to Hundley. I went to the girl who was running the letters page of the Daily Illini, and I said, I have here a letter. I said, I would very much like you to publish it tonight for two reasons. One, it corrects some errors in your news reporting, and I think that the other side of your view of the world, and in particular what happens when the world doesn't respond to you, needs to be presented, and so here it is. And she turned around to me and said something like the following, and here's where I wish I had people here to keep me right. She said, we can't guarantee anybody that his letter will be printed. Who are you? I said, who am I? I said, I am one of the best writers the Daily Illini has ever had, said I. You've got something in the Chicago Journalism Review reprinted there because I wrote it. I'm good. I said, I've written hundreds of inches of stuff for your paper. That's who I am. But that has nothing to do with what we're talking about. I have a letter here. And she said, yes, I see. It's enormously long. She said, we don't have room for that letter. And I said, I knew you didn't have room for that letter, and that's why I came over here, because I'm willing to pare it down to any length that you do have room for. Now, I can do that. I said, I'm good at editing my own stuff. I said, 3 inches. You give me 3 inches, I'll push it down to 3 inches. But tell me how much space you've got for my letter. She goes, that's not the way we operate. We don't just tell you how much space you have. I can't tell you I'm going to print your letter. I haven't seen the other letters that were coming in today. Let me see it, she says. So she takes my letter. She took, according to my watch, 7 minutes to read the first page. She looked around. She chewed on popcorn. She talked to other people. It took her 7 minutes to get through the first page, and she turns it over and kind of reads the second page. It took her 15 minutes to read through it. She got out and she said, this is too long, and it certainly needs to be tightened up, she said. And she began to give me a lecture on my style. And I said, I'm not writing. I said, after having just told you a moment ago that I often write for you, I'm not writing for you today. I'm just giving a letter to the editor. Now, will you tell me how long it's got to be, and I will cut it to that if you've got any chance of putting it in. And she said, we have people who brought letters in days ago that haven't been printed yet. Why should we print yours ahead of theirs? And I said, I don't know, but if there's a chance, just tell me how long it would have to be, and I'll cut it down to that, you see. And it went on a little longer than that. It took about 20 minutes. Then finally she said 17 inches. I had a magic figure, so I went to a desk. This was at this time, 4:30 in the afternoon. I went to a desk at the Daily Illini, and for 1 hour I pared my 24-inch long piece down 17 inches. Now, some of you people will know what that means. That is an act. That's hard. You cross off a word, you cross off a phrase, you figure a shorter way to say it. You wanted that thing, but you finally say, all right, sacrifice it. Got it down to 17 inches, you know? Okay, I gave it to her. Neat copy, I might add, neater than most of the stuff that gets typed up. Gave it to her, and I left. And I went to dinner, and I told someone, I must have told Don, how frustrated I was with the Daily Illini and what a battle it had been, and how funny it had been that this little girl who doesn't know me treats me just probably the way she treats everybody. I've gone in there hundreds of times and had my stuff printed at the drop of a dime, but I always go to the top honcho, somebody I know. See? But this time I went through the usual channel. Note that, usual channel. So the evening wore on, and it got to be 10:30. Now, I've learned from many years of dealing with the Daily Illini that even when you went to the top honcho, anything can happen. So you usually go back about 10:30 and you proofread your own stuff, because if you don't, the paragraphs may be out of order, the type upside down, or you know, they might have cut out. But they have a fascinating way of always cutting the central paragraph. And I don't write in that way so that the last 85 paragraphs diminish in importance and none of them are needed at all. I'm afraid that there's sort of a coherence to my stuff, unfortunately, so that you can't just lop off the end. So I was a little worried, and I called her up and I said, hi, I said, this is Dave Eisenman. Did I get it down to 17 inches? And she said, we'll discuss that Monday night. Now, this was Thursday night. Now, the Daily Illini publishes Tuesday through Saturday, and they don't have any editorials or letters on Saturday. So if we were going to be discussing this Monday night, that meant that it wasn't going to be published Friday, and of course it couldn't be published Saturday, and it certainly couldn't be published Sunday or Monday since they don't even publish, so it had to be Tuesday would be the earliest it would be published. I said, oh, that means that you're going to publish it on Tuesday, said I. Clever. I catch on. She said, no, I can't guarantee that. She says, of course, the governor's coming tomorrow, and anything could happen. I mean, our campus could, we could have riots, anything could happen, and I can't tell you how much space we'll have on Tuesday. She said, I'm not promising you that we'll publish it on Tuesday. I'm just telling you that we might discuss that on Monday night. And I said, look, I thought we agreed this afternoon. I admit, I did not have an ironclad agreement with you people to publish that letter, but I said, I have compelling reasons for thinking that ought to be in there tomorrow. In the first place, you've reported the event factually wrong twice, and secondly, the governor is coming tomorrow, and you yourself admit there's a potential for violence, and if anyone believed for a moment that anyone read the Daily Illini, which I hope you believe, and if anyone thought that people were even least bit influenced by the Daily Illini, which I hope you believe, you would agree that it would be in the interest of the public to get right the facts about Seal, particularly when they were used as an argument to suggest that the only thing one had left was breaking windows when the governor is going to be in town. And I said, I should think that you would see where there might be some real value to publishing that thing on Friday. I said, and I thought we'd been through that this afternoon, and I admit you didn't promise me anything, but what happened between 4:30 and now? She said, look at here. She says, you're getting very abusive. She said, we can't guarantee you that we'll print any letter that anybody brings to us. Who do you think you are? She said, lots of other people have letters here that are more important than yours. And besides, there are other things going on in the world besides you and Seal. She says, and besides that, she says, I don't work for the front page. I work for the letters page. And if there were errors on the front page, don't come crying to me about that, she said. She also said, somewhere in this conversation, I might add, that I cannot expect too high a degree of accuracy from the Daily Illini because they're all volunteers and they don't get paid. I found that very interesting, and I told her that I thought that was most interesting. I said, does that mean that factual errors in the Daily Illini are to be excused by the fact that, well, anyway, this is all getting too detailed. We had a rather heated conversation. I finally accused her of giving me all the same arguments she'd given me in the afternoon without really anything new. And I said, what you are doing is you have taken a dislike to my attitude, young lady, and you're looking for any reason you can find not to print my letter. And I think it's a personal thing, and I think it's reprehensible. And so I'm really irritated. And I said, now just you tell me, give me one good thing that has changed between 4:30 this afternoon and now. You're giving me all the same old stuff you gave me then. And she said, well, I keep telling you the school board election. I said, the school board election, what's that got to do with anything? And she, Peter thinks it's, he got elected. He should be worried about that. But I didn't think it was very important relative, you know, to what I was worried about. So anyway, she said, well, you see, we have some letters that bear on the school board election, and if we don't print them tomorrow, they can never be printed, quite obviously, since the election's on Saturday. And I said, I understand it. I said, I understand it. You are exhibiting all of the behavior that I talked about in my letter to you. I said, and what has happened here is a simple bureaucratic rule has ruled my letter out. There's no obvious expiration date built into my letter. But there is in the letters that bear on the school board election. And even if they're utterly devoid of content, even if they're useless to anyone in making up his mind about voting in the school board election, regardless of what's in them, the fact that they run out tomorrow means you've got to print them tomorrow, which puts them ahead of mine. Isn't that right? And she said, well, that's, you know. I said, but look, I want to take back all the angry words. I said, I'm not angry at you anymore. I understand. It isn't a personal thing. It's the usual thing you get. It's a stupid bureaucratic rule. And you and I are just part of a system, and I'm not going to have my letter printed for reasons that are really, in some sense, beyond both of our control. Do you understand that? I said, I'm insisting to you that I'm no longer angry at you. I want that clear. She says, okay. I said, oh, but wait a minute before you hang up. I said, it seems to me that according to your second editorial today that... After one of these things happens to one, when he's as irritated as I obviously am and frustrated, having spent hours working on getting this thing in, you see, and then loses for a reason as stupid as this one, don't you agree that I would be justified in breaking glass? It says here that the Daily Line would understand, and then down below it suggests that this is what one does. And she said, did you? She said, we have had a window broken over here already tonight. And I said, no, I didn't break your window. But I said, I should. So I hung up. I got to thinking about it. Well, there were a lot of things going on in my office, and other people phoned in and out, and I finally called somebody about something, and I told him this wild story. I said, it's so funny because my letter was about these circumstances, and they have exhibited all the behavior which they see in the rest of the world and find evil in, and I have seen it in them, and all I see is what I always see, which is screaming incompetence, okay? I mean, in some sense, in a broad sense. I said, I really ought to throw a bottle through the window. I ought to really just play it right down to the hilt because I know she didn't understand. She didn't get the point. She said she did, but she just wanted to hang up. I said, I'm going to do it. And I hung up. He had, however, said, you're not going to do it. And I said, yes, I am. And I hung up. So then I got up and I went downstairs. Now, I wasn't sure I was going to do it, so I had a lot of things to do. I picked up my mail. I always mail the mail about that hour. And I take it over near the Daily Line because those are the fastest mailboxes in Champaign-Urbana. You got a fast campus mailbox that gets things there. If you put them in by 6 in the morning, they're out by either in people's hands by 10. It's a good deal. And there's a fast U.S. mailbox. So I picked up my mail and I took it. And when I reached the door of the building in which I live, I didn't introduce myself. Nobody knows who I am. Probably just as well. When I reached the door of the building in which I lived, there was a lot of pop bottles there, and I picked one up, and I thought, now this is really stupid. They've got plenty of their own, so I put it back. And then I headed over there. Now, I was getting a little bit nervous. You know, I was shaking a little bit because it's not part of my makeup to break windows. I can't, in fact, recall ever in my life having broken anything before. It's a new experience. And in some sense, I didn't really know what was going to happen. I hadn't really thought it through any more than I've just told you. I didn't know it was going to happen, except I thought I was probably going to break their window. But I didn't know whether I would assemble them and lecture them first and then break their window. I wasn't clear on how it was going to work at all. I just started heading over that way. And then fate stepped in. And as I reached the back of the union, John Hundley walked out of the union, the editor of the Daily Line. And I said, John, I'm so glad to see you. And I went over and I put my arm on it and I said, I'm so glad to see you because as we walk together over to the Daily Line, I'm going to explain to you why I'm going to break your window. And he kind of looked at me with kind of a sick little grin and said, oh no. He says, what's this all about? What have we done now? And I said, well, you know that letter. And I said, well, after working on it for an hour and so on, I said, your little girl's not going to print it for me. He says, oh. Why? And I told him, I said, I've got it all figured out. She's got these letters that run out, you see. So that clearly puts them ahead of mine, even if there's nothing in them. Don't you see, Hundley? It's a perfect, perfect picture of the way bureaucracies fail. It's lovely. And you're a part of it. It's just wonderful. And he said, oh, brother. He said, I've probably got to talk to her. So we walked over there. He said, but of course you're kidding about the window. No, I said, I'm going to break your window. And so we walked down into the Daily Illini and still talking a little bit about that. And he turned his back on me, and that was his fatal mistake. That was his fatal mistake, because the second he turned his back, I said, God damn, they really do have me labeled, don't they? Nice guy, huh? He never break a window. And I said, that's the straw. Well, I didn't even think all that. All I know is when he turned his back, I knew I was going to do it. There was just the big cosmic flash that says, you're going to bust the window. Blah! And after at that point, I lose all sense of weight and time and anything else. I can't tell you how I got to the Daily Lioness bottle rack. I can't really tell you how I got back below the window. I have a sensation that my feet floated, that I wasn't touching the floor, okay? And my arm, the bottle didn't weigh anything. It was fantastic, and it just arched up there. And I've never been able to play catch in my life because I can't catch and I can't throw. But it went right directly through the middle of that window. Splash! Like that. Wrong. Okay. Well, I then turned around. I didn't really even see it. In fact, I turned around through the bottle, and I turned around, and it crashed behind me. And Hundley's jaw dropped about to his knees. He turned around looking at me saying, oh, no, you didn't do that. And Simon, who he's talking to, kind of pops up. And people flow out of the back room and line up in the doorway. And then I got a little scared because the guys came out of the shop. And they're big guys, you know. And all these people, and I didn't even think it had been quite that loud, but it seemed as if the room was just filling up. So there I was facing them. So I took the paper and I said to them, the violence you have just seen was caused in part by the Daily Illini's refusal to be responsive to my reasonable requests. I said, this latest act of high-handed, devil-may-care dictatorship, this escapade has cost you roughly $20 in worth of broken glass, I said, and then I took the paper and handed it to Hundley and left. Okay. So then I went out and I walked half a block and I mailed my campus mail and then I mailed my U.S. mail. I was quite excited. I haven't been able to give you how excited I was. My voice broke, my mouth was thick. It's thick today, but not half as thick. It was clearly an agitated person that they saw deliver those two paragraphs to them. I made a great effort to become de-agitated. It wasn't hard. I then walked back to the Daily Illini, and there were a certain number of people out front looking at the glass and saying, what did he use? And somebody said, a pop bottle. No kidding. Which kind? Pepsi Cola. All right. Now I'm going to go to the notes I took right after that. Ah, yes. So I walked by them. Well, they were a little surprised at that, so everyone followed me back in. Here I am walking by them, you know. So they all follow me, and they want to see what's going to happen next, you know. I'm saying a lot of you knows. I'm sorry about that. There was Simon, still where he was, right inside the front door earlier, and I said, hi, Roger, I'd like to talk about it. At this point, Hundley came running out of his office saying, don't anybody talk to him. Don't get him more excited than he is. Dave, the officer, we're really sorry. It's our fault. He says, we shouldn't have done it. We really should have published a letter. He grabs me by the arm, and I said, John, I said, calm down. It has nothing to do with that. And he kind of comes back with, I said, it has nothing to do with that. So just relax. I'm not even remotely angry at the Daily Illini. It hasn't got anything to do with this. And so what we're now going to discuss is whether or not that would ever be an appropriate response to the kind of thing I went through with you people today. That's what it's all about. Well, he then turned and went back into his office and closed the door, and that left me with Roger Simon and a number of other people. And Roger said, among other things, let's see if I can find what Roger said. There was really a lot of good stuff happened there. I guess I don't have it. All right, we'll have to do our best. Roger said, you can't tell me that that was a rational act, that you just sat over in your office and decided you were going to show the Daily Illini lesson, came over here and threw that bottle through the window, because you were clearly very excited, very agitated and hyper-emotional. I said, was I ever? I said, it was great. Man, I said, was I ever on a trip? My feet didn't touch the ground, a bottle arched through the air, it was beautiful. And so it is every time somebody throws a brick through a window, Roger Simon. I don't think it ever is an irrational act. It ought to worry you a little bit about causation, shouldn't it? You know, he did that because. Oh, mm-hmm. He says, well, what was it all about? So then I told him what it was all about. We went through the whole story about how the letter hadn't been published and so on and so forth, and how insane it was that this set of priorities, speaking of their previous comments about the higher board, you know, remember the higher board was guilty of lack of commitment, stupidity, and entirely messed up priorities. Uh-huh. So I said, speaking of priorities, I rather think that my letter has rather more importance than some of the stuff that you will undoubtedly print. And I said, I don't know what you're going to print. I haven't seen the letters yet, but I'm willing to bet you tomorrow morning when that paper comes out, you won't be able to justify your choice of letters. And that's what it's all about, in some sense. Okay, but now that's what I went through with you, the galling feeling that even when you know you're right, and when you agree that I am right, I still can't get the thing done. Okay? And he goes, but you can't say that the violence wasn't in some way effective, because he said, you're breaking the window has called my attention to the situation. I hadn't seen your letter. He says, I completely agree with you now. I think you're probably right. Your letter is more important than what we're likely to publish. And I said, okay, Roger Simon, then are you going to publish it? That's the test. I said, I don't want your commiseration. I'm not interested in convincing you. I don't want you to pat me on the back and say I'm right. I want my letter published. Are you going to publish it? Now, before you answer, I said, let me point out to you that if you do publish the letter, I can go around town and I can say, oh, you're having trouble having your letter published at the Daily Illini. Well, I said, on the other hand, I know how you can get their attention. That's, you know, it's a simple way. Now, I said, on the other hand, if you don't publish it, you certainly can't ask me to be satisfied with your commiseration, because the chancellor often pats you on the back and says, Roger, I agree with you completely, but there's no way to do it. I said, you don't find that very satisfying, and you shouldn't expect me to find it satisfying. Now, I said, let's say you're willing to take the chance. Let's say you're willing to give in, not only to threats of force and violence, but to real violence, and publish it. I said, it just may be that you can't publish it anyway for technical reasons. You pay your union, and they have a deal with you. They set so much type every night, they've already set the other letters, Roger Simon, and you just might not be able to get it in there. At this point, somebody said, how are we going to explain the fact that the glass is going out? I said, that's your problem, and I left. All right. I got as far as the union. I decided my throat was dry, so I got something to drink. Then I called the campus police. I said, good evening. I said, this is David Eisenman. I'm an assistant dean of student personnel. I must digress here to point out that that editorial that I quoted from, changing a few words, actually went on to say,